Welcome to the Good Listening To show on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. The feel-good show that brings you The Clearing, where all good questions come to be asked and all good stories come to be told. And where all my guests have two things in common. They are all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors, a clearing, a tree, a storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, some Shakespeare, and a cake. So yes, who are you, what's your story, and what life's lessons learned along your way would you like to share with us? So, welcome to a GLT with me, CG. See what I'm doing there, and we're recording.
Recording progress.
We are recording on the Zoom hole. Welcome to my Zoom hole, but the program's not called that. It's Welcome to the Good Listening Show here on UK Health Radio. And it's my great pleasure to welcome to a very wonderfully charged creative space called The Clearing, which is the sort of epicenter of what this show is about. The Clearing is where all good questions come to be asked and all good stories come to be told. And then we're going to curate this lovely man, Toby Hulse, ladies and gentlemen, who is very welcome to The Clearing. So I'll just give you a round of applause to say hello.
And hello.
Hello, Toby Hulse. Now, Toby is a very, very natural storyteller, and I'm very excited to talk to him. He lives in Taunton now. That's not strictly relevant, but we were in Bristol, and he's part of the sort of Bristol circuit and global circuit of really wonderful natural storytelling theatre practitioners. I know that you say of yourself, you're a playwright, theatre director and creative practitioner. I've always known you as a natural storyteller because actually, if I may, not to age us both my children, now 21 and 14, grew up on a series of shows at the Old Vic that you devised, created, curated. As we've just discovered, it's called No Loud Bangs. But what I remember in it was a giraffe, a bunny rabbit, a tent, a dog and a clown. And it just went on in a beautiful way. And there was a reincorporation each Christmas where, honestly, it was Lily's first theatre experience. And she's 21 and learning to be a primary school teacher, indeed lining her toys up with lesson plans from the get-go. And I'd like to thank you in no small part, I believe, for that, Toby, sincerely, because I think it's that inspired her to think, a bit like alongside Toy Story, that your toys could come alive, which is a wonderful thing.
They can. They absolutely can.
Welcome. So it's really lovely to talk to you. And in the spirit of improvisation, which I know you also teach, as soon as I got in touch with you to ask you if I could interview you, you immediately, a man after my own heart, said yes. We also started to correspond and I just happened to say huzzah and you got back in touch to say huzzah was your favourite word. And then it keeps on giving, because even when I asked you to send me some biographical stuff, you said, here's some stuffage for you. And I was able to go, lovely stuffage. And then finally, when I did a WhatsApp to explain through what we're going to do, you then did another Bristolian thing. You went, cheers, drive. Because what's lovely is I'm going to be driving the narrative with you joining me as we give you a good listening to here on the show. So you're very welcome. It's now time to get you on the open road of who are you and what's your story. So tell me, how's morale? What's your story of the day, please?
My story of the day. This morning I have been working on an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland. And I'd always said to myself that I would never, ever touch Alice in Wonderland, because as much as I love nonsense, it's just too nonsensical. And actually, I don't find it holds together as a story. Alice seems to learn nothing. Nothing is achieved. but as with all good artists, if someone offers you money to do something, you have a go. So I've been looking at Alice in Wonderland and trying to tease the story out of that wonderful collection of nonsense, which actually really does make no sense whatsoever. And actually, I'm finding it's a celebration of the things that we do as children, which do not make any sense. And trying to find the theatrical version of that has been a joy, actually. That's my story of the day.
So if I may, you've taken yourself down a bit of a rabbit hole on that one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
See what I did there. So it's all to play for. I'm going to curate you through the lovely storytelling metaphors of, and this is what it's all to play for, there's going to be the clearing and then a tree, alchemy, gold, cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and then a cake. And I also know that we have the particular Shakespeare that I've struck upon, the Seven Ages of Man speech, I know that was the epicentre to your own play, which you've done as a quick bounce through Shakespeare, which is called The Rough Guide to Shakespeare.
That's right, yes.
So when we get to that part, please do tell us about that, because that's a lovely resonance we also have in mind. Mm. So let's get on the open road. What is a clearing like for you, Toby Hulse, as I say, playwright, theatre director and creative practitioner? Where do you go? What is your clearing? Where is your clearing to get clutter-free and able to think?
I think that the place where my mind is the clearest is on public transport. I love a train journey. I love a bus journey. I also like cycling. That's obviously not public transport, but there's something about the act of moving from one place to another, and particularly on a train or a bus where you have nothing else to do, which I find really clearing of the mind. I like to turn my phone off and just enjoy the time that it takes to get from one place to another place. As you said, at the moment, I'm staying in Taunton, but I'm still working in Bristol, which gives you about an hour each way of beautiful, clear time on public transport. I'm a big fan of buses in particular. There's very little about the Bristol bus timetable that I don't know. So if you ever want any recommendations, I have to let you know how to get various different places.
And by the way, that makes complete sense of your WhatsApp picture, because you are stood in front of some sort of, I think it's a train timetable, isn't it, on a train?
It is, yes. I hadn't even realised that. Yeah, that was taken on Oxford train station. I was waiting for a train to come back to Bristol. I'd been working at the Oxford Playhouse and was on my journey home to back to Bristol.
And you're in good and illustrious company, in that I know people like Michael Palin also love being on trains and journeys around the world, that sort of thing. So I love the fact that you go, it's the place from A to B, that space is the gap.
It's the gap. The gap's the important bit. It's the, I find also when cycling as well, there's something about the physical activity involved in cycling, which stimulates the brain. I'm not a cyclist who dons Lycra and goes around the Somerset Levels on a Sunday. I always have to be going somewhere. But I love travelling in Bristol by bike and leaving my flat and travelling to the Bristol Old Vic or to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School or wherever I happen to be working that day. And that time taken on the road, engaged in physical activity, is a real brain stimulator. But I have to be going somewhere. That's why I could never have a rowing machine.
Because it's just too static. Nor would you strap your bike to one of those places where you just pedal off the spot. I've got a romantic image of you because you're a director with scripts akimbo, with some sort of lady basket at the front with lots of scripts.
Oh, I wish. I actually had one of those bicycles once, but they're incredibly heavy. It was a proper like 50s one with pushrod brakes, and it looked beautiful, but it was impossible to cycle anywhere. And in Bristol, you need more than three Sturmey Archer gears, I find.
You do. And in fact, I've recently struck upon an adage for myself in Bristol, which is no hill defeats me, because I love my bike too. My bike is my freedom. So I love that you like riding as well. Wonderful. And also we have the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School in common. I know that you've been a long-standing part of the education department at the Bristol Old Vic, but also at the theatre school. To this very day, you are still teacher of improvisation, clowning and devising.
Right. Yeah.
Hurrah. So if I may, I'm going to join you then with a tree, rather comically, aboard the public transport of your choice. So we'll go with train, shall we? Because that's what you said, first of all.
I think I'd prefer the X1 bus, please.
Which
between Western Supermare and the Bristol bus station.
I love that. We've got a specific...
It travels via such glorious places as Congresbury, Yatton, Backwell. It takes a lovely, circuitous route to Bristol through some lovely countryside. So yeah, we're on the X1 bus.
I'm loving the language choices so far. Things like circuitous, and I said lady basket, which I enjoyed and didn't ever expect to be saying in my life. So it's the X1 bus, to be really specific.
Yeah. Yes.
And as we're being really specific, what time of day do I join you with a tree?
I think it's late afternoon. So I'm returning from Bristol. The sun's just coming down. And we will be passing specifically past Cleve Nursery.
Lovely. And I know you said you wanted to turn your phone off, so excuse the interruption. I'm going to stand right next to you now with a shrubbery. It's a bit sort of Waiting for Godot-esque, the tree. The idea is it's a lovely metaphor where we can shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. And you were kind enough before we spoke to have thought about four things that have shaped you, three things that inspire you, two things that never fail to grab your attention, borrowed from the film Up. This will be familiar to listeners now. Oh, squirrels, which is that lovely doggy distraction thing. And then finally, a quirky or unusual fact about you, Toby Hulse, that we couldn't possibly know until you tell us. So here I am in your X1 bus, interrupting your journey with my tree. Over to you to shake your canopy, please.
Right, we'll give it a good shake. So we're going, starting with the four things that have shaped me. That's the question, isn't it?
Yes.
I would say one of the, and it links in with buses actually and trains. One of the things that I believe has shaped me is that my parents separated when I was 10 and then later divorced. And we spent a lot of time, my brother and sister and I, we lived with my dad during the term time, and then we'd go and visit my mum during the holidays, and any bits where it was kind of rough between my parents, we'd go and stay with my grandparents who lived near Lewes in Sussex. So in effect, I was brought up by five different people. And when we would go to visit my mum, she was living in Cambridge and had a vast selection of friends drawn from people who were at the university, local squat punks. She worked with a housing, a hostel for homeless men. So there was any number of people, adults in our lives, from about the age of 10, 11 onwards. And there's one of my favourite books is called Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. It's a book of Roman philosophy. Yes. And the opening section of that, he says, is a bit where he goes, from my father, I learned this, from my mother, I learned. And he goes through each of the adults who influenced him in his life. And I can say with all sincerity that every single one of those adults in my life taught me something different, sometimes quite contradictory things, but all of those different influences shaped the way that I grew up. I don't remember much of my life before the age of 10, I think probably because it must have been very stable, secure and predictable. But between the age of 10, 11 and 18, I have very, very vivid memories, particularly of my teenage years, and the influences that came from, you know, my father, who's a wonderful, quiet, but very straight-laced man, from my stepmother, who's very forthright, opinionated, and gloriously loving. My mother, who's wild and completely out of this world, she's a hippie anyway. Yes. Without unapologetic hippie.
Yeah, yeah,
And free spirit. And then from my two grandparents who were just Victorians. So we had this also this kind of English high tea kind of.
What a lovely way to describe your grandparents. They were just Victorians. I love that.
And I think I mean temporarily they were just Victorians, but actually they probably were just Victorians.
Also, I loved how you described out of the disruption of the contradictory advice and the disruption to your life, you know, which in other hands may have made you fall between several cracks. You're able to find your own narrative through that and make up your own mind.
And we were encouraged very early to get the best bits from various different experiences, even ones that would seem quite negative. And there were some bits of growing up that were quite hairy. And when I reflect on them as an adult and now being a parent as well, I think, would I want my own children to go through those particular situations? But actually the positive things that came out of that and the way it helped me understand the world. I mean, as a 13-year-old, to be mixing with homeless men and squat punks, and my mum's lodger was in the early 80s, was a PhD student in English literature who liked to wear a black velvet Victorian dress around the house. we met all sorts of bizarre and wonderful people.
How many brothers and sisters did you have? Because you're using the lovely collective we.
Yes. So I've got a brother who's about as close to me in age as it's biologically possible to be, and then a sister who's 4 years younger than me. So I'm the old, and then it's, yeah. the three of us together, and we were a very close knit, still are a very close knit unit.
And by the way, I love the Marcus Aurelius reference, one of my favourite quotes, even about the pandemic, which you may have to help me finish because I didn't know we were going to be talking about that, is never worry about the future because you will always greet it with the same weapons of reason that today arm you against your present is the gist of it.
It's extraordinary book, that, and it's really, really...
Say the title again, just to hang it there.
It's usually published as Meditations, and I think it's a collection of his writings. I can also recommend, whilst we're on Marcus Aurelius, a book by Derren Brown called Happy, which is a kind of modern take on Marcus Aurelius, which is a little bit more accessible, requires less classical knowledge, and has Derren Brown's wit in it as well.
And then a much nowhere near as highbrow reference in the film Gladiator, Marcus Aurelius is played by Richard Harris, isn't it, as the general, I think. Wonderful. So I loved the journey of that, and the memories really beginning from sort of 10 onwards with that idea of disruption, but out of adversity comes great creativity. And the shaping and the hewing of the man that becomes subsequently Toby Huxley. Mm. That's a lovely starter for what shaped you. So next to continuing the shape age.
Okay, it's funny, as we talk, I can start to spot patterns, which I hadn't noticed. So here's another one where out of something adverse comes something else. So when I was, my final year at university, I went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival with a show which was an adaptation of a short story by Gogol called The Nose. And at the time, this was 88, everyone was really into Stephen Burkoff. So what this means for those who aren't familiar with his theatre is it's a lot of people dressed in white shirts and black trousers moving very, very slowly and beautifully on stage with kind of outbursts of violent behaviour and slightly clown-like makeup. And like many people of students taking shows to Edinburgh that year, I thought I had made a Stephen Burkoff show out of The Nose. And we put this beautifully crafted piece onto the stage for the first performance, and the audience roared with laughter. I mean, like properly, like belly laughed at this thing that we'd made. And we sat in the pub afterwards going, this is peculiar. We thought we'd made a hardcore Stephen Burkoff social, what's going on? And we realised that what we had done is accidentally we had put all of our rehearsal jokes onto the stage alongside this other stuff. And what we'd created was a clown show, even though I didn't know that clown shows existed. This was all new to me. So we were able to go back the next day and listen carefully to where the laughs were and then work on those bits and find and ask ourselves, why are these things funny? What is it that's making the audience laugh? And by the end of the fourth week of the run, we had a really fantastic show, which actually has informed nearly every piece of theatre I've done since. And it was led by the audience. It was led by us trying to understand our own mistake, trying to understand what had gone wrong. One of the last few shows, someone came to review it, and they came to see us afterwards and said, "Did you all train at Goliath?" Who's this French clown teacher, for those who aren't familiar with him. And we said, no, who's Goliath? And we kind of invented clowning by mistake, or rather reinvented it. Obviously, it's been a tradition of thousands of years old. But that sense of having the strength to give up on something was really, there was a very important lesson to me there. You know, I thought I'd made one thing, I'd made something else. So instead of going, I insist that it's the thing I've made. I say, well, what have I made then? What is this?
Also, I'm fascinated by, you know, congratulations for not killing it or stamping on it because you tried to overanalyze it, because you're getting the huge laughs. There was immense spontaneity. And yet, then you took the risk of trying to analyze that, because often if you analyze comedy, it can generally...
There's a very interesting thing that I've realized about comedy, which is... If you perform in a comedy and it goes really well, you go to the pub afterwards and you all have a drink and say, oh, it was brilliant, and then you'll finish your drink. And if it goes badly, you go to the pub afterwards, you have a drink and you go, oh, it was your fault, you cut me off on that line. And you spend all your time concentrating on what's gone wrong. What I try to do is flip it the other way. So when it goes well, that's when I analyse.
Yes.
And when it goes badly, I just think, well, we'll never have to do that show again. And it's really useful for improvisation as well, because obviously you can never create improvisation, but it's good to know why something has worked rather than why it hasn't worked. And that's kind of guiding principle for me, I think, for everyone.
And, you know, profoundly learning from the mistakes as well, tweaking the mistakes, you know, making it more definite, more sure-footed.
Yeah.
A lot of theatre is about swimming metaphorically away from the reef where it gets a bit cold because you're risking more. But then to get safer in that means that you can pull audiences to a really unfamiliar place but do it with safety.
Yes, it's. But I think that's the same with not to start sermonising, but I think it's the same with life as well, actually, which is, you know, learn from the successes. And when things go wrong, just go, it went wrong, and then move on. I think that's something.
I've heard that same idea framed beautifully recently as when shit happens or stuff happens, to just go, well, plot twist, and then work out how to adapt.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, I think that's what I learned from that show. That's a good.
And how beautifully formative that was, because as you've said very generously to your own canon of work, that informed everything that followed since.
Yes, yeah. I've basically been trying to tell the same joke over and over again from the age of 21 onwards.
Well, you're in good company. I've been doing it from younger. Same old cobblers rehashed for decades. Marvellous. So I think we're having a lovely journey shaking your tree. I still think we're in the shapeage foliage, if I may.
Yes, yeah. So a third thing that shaped me was, I thought about this actually for the amusing fact that you might not know about me, but when I first left university, I thought I was going to go and work in the theatre and become incredibly famous very quickly. Actually, what happened is I ended up in London without any work whatsoever. And I went to Office Angels in High Holborn and said, you know, I've got a degree in English. I've been working in theatre. I can put you up some not very good scaffolding and some not very good wooden things that will last about a week. Now, what job have you got for me? And they said, you've got a degree in English. You're probably good at putting things in alphabetical order. And I said, yeah, I'm well on that. And they gave me a job at Morgan Stanley International, which is an American investment bank. And I ended up working there for 18 months, slowly getting more and more responsibility, slowly learning more and more about how merchant and investment banking works, until it got to the point where they were just about to offer me a full-time professional job, which would have been a massive mortgage subsidy and a car and, you know, a suit and all this kind of thing. And they sent me on a training course before I accepted the post. And after a day and a half of training, and this guy was the best trainer I've ever encountered, because he was teaching someone who had no interest in finance whatsoever, i.e. me, about how finance works. He was brilliant, and my understanding of global investment banking was good then. But at the end of the day and a half, he did the, you know, has anyone got any questions about what we've done over this last period? And there were lots of Harvard graduates there who were like, yeah, so we're interested in the mortgage-backed bond market in Australia. And so there was all this stuff coming out. And I put my hand up and I said, I just want to compliment you on your training. It's really good. I've learned an incredible amount about how banking works, but you haven't told me why banking, what is it? And he said, And he said, are you asking me if we serve any useful moral function? I said, yeah, I suppose I am asking you that question. And he said, we don't. He was completely honest and said, we don't. Now we exist, the world can't do without us, but we have no useful function in society. In your turn, what you're thinking about. And I left that evening thinking, blimey. I mean, I appreciate your honesty. But that it really shook me somewhere. And that evening I went to the Cambridge Arms, which is in Cambridge Circus, near where Les Mis is playing. And I was sitting on a table recounting this to my friend, and the table next to me, a woman leant over and said, well, if you think that's bad, you should try being a teacher. And I thought, you know what, I've never thought of being a teacher. And she was a primary school teacher, and she taught reception children, four and 5 year olds in Walthamstow. And she said, come into my class, come and see what it's like. So I went into her class and spent the day as a volunteer in the class. And that was it. It turned something on in my head about I knew that I wanted any employment that I had to have some kind of moral or use, some useful function to society. And I guess I'd always ruled out teaching because I thought teachers worked in secondary school. So I'd forgotten all about primary school. And it also introduced me to 4 and 5 year olds who I didn't, you know, as a 23 year old man, I didn't know any 4 and 5 year olds. I hadn't got to the point yet where my friends were having children and I didn't have any children. And I really enjoyed the company of 34 and 5 year olds in an educational setting. And I liked the way they played and I liked the way that play was a way of learning. And I left London shortly afterwards and went and trained as a teacher. And I taught in nursery and reception classes for 6 years before finally going back to theatre. And I've always said if theatre fell through, I would really happily go back to work in nursery and reception classes because, yeah, there's something about that involvement with children of that age.
Such a profound attuned to your own purpose story there about how you were going to get sucked into a vortex of deep unhappiness and despair and disconnection from a purpose of your own core value. And what's so delicious is that someone eavesdropping then plants a sort of depth charge of gold, which then pulls you towards your purpose. And it sounded like her imperative at the beginning, oh, you think that's bad, as if she was going to take you deeper. But actually what she meant was, this is the antidote.
Yes, yeah. You know, if you complain about your job, there's always someone who will complain about their job more. But actually it was the thing, it was a turning point for me. And I was quite directionless and I would probably have gone into the bank. This is what you do if you've got a degree and you're in London and you need money. And I don't know where I'd be now, but that it was a really defining moment that evening.
And I'm not just being nice to you, because of my own children's experience of your theatre making, I think the world is a richer place for you being a storyteller rather than a banker. And I don't mean any disservice to anyone who might be working in that field. Yeah. But as you said, you found a really wonderful teacher within that environment. And what was the name? Do you remember the name of the teacher that eavesdropped that day that changed your life?
Belinda Young.
And is she still out there and you're still in touch?
I don't know. We were actually in a relationship for a little while after that. Then she went off to Germany and I kind of lost contact with her. But I can still remember that really vividly.
Such a lovely, lovely plunge into the archive of Toby Hulse's sort of, it's sometimes called the source work, isn't it? When you look back on where it all began, this happened and this happened. And oh, guess what? This happened. And so that's such an extraordinary night in the pub. Windows of opportunity. And also I've been struck on a quote, which is what's meant for you won't pass you by, but you've got to be truly present to what the world is telling you in order to tune into that. Lovely stuff, Toby. Thank you. So I think we might be at the point of three things that inspire you now, even though there could be some overlap, obviously.
Yeah. So again, I noticed a kind of a common theme running through these as I've spent the 5 minutes thinking about it. So one thing that really inspires me is the novel Moby Dick by Herman Melville. And what I like about it, not only is it a thundering good read, but he can't help but cram into it as much as he possibly can. It's like reading every single book simultaneously and watching every single play simultaneously. It's like it's a cross between the Bible and the sea shanty. And it's extraordinary. And there's something about the ridiculous ambition of that novel. Another one that fits into the same genre is Les Miserables. Which again is a massive, and it's like Victor Hugo can't resist putting in an essay about the French Revolution, and then you know his own thoughts about the Battle of Waterloo, and then a bit of plot, and then it's that kind of mad eclectic imagination. And Moby Dick, I've read the book so many times, and every time it inspires me, excites me, puzzles me. There are bits I've got no idea what's going on in it. It's great book.
I so relate to that. It's the idea of a smorgasbord and a buffet, and I'm slightly food obsessed, and it's about just shoving everything in your face.
If in doubt, put something else in. It's great.
And indeed, I thought that was a gentle dig at the fact that I've crammed in loads to get you to answer about this as well. But I thank you for the Moby Dick reference as being an inspirational source for you. That's so wonderful. Because you never fail to delight with the amount of, you know, inventiveness that's going on in theatre pieces.
I don't think you can have too much. I don't think there is such a thing as too much.
Well, but you should see me at a buffet. It is possible to stuff too much. Wonderful. Back to you.
And second is the paintings of the painter Uccello. Now, I don't know if you know, Uccello was a sort of mid-Renaissance painter. And he became completely obsessed with perspective. So perspective is just being explored, rediscovered. And famous paintings of his include the Battle of San Romano, which is in the National, and there's another version of it in the Uffizi. The one I particularly enjoy is called Hunt in the Forest, which is in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. And what's brilliant about the work of Uccello is, although he's so obsessed with a perspective, he can't do it. He's like the ultimate clown painter. He's got failure all over his work. I have a print of The Hunt in the Forest above my kitchen sink, and so the trees are all perfect. Remember in junior school where you learn perspective and you do train tracks?
Yes.
It's as good or as bad as that. So the trees all line up very neatly in rows so that he can demonstrate how that he can do trees getting smaller.
Would you be kind enough to share that so I can share it if people want to see it as well?
Yeah, do that. Oh, no, I'm not in my house at the moment, unfortunately.
No, but when you can, I mean, postscript, yes. If you can.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the Battle of San Romano, all the corpses fall along the lines of perspective. They're exceptionally bad paintings.
So bad they're brilliant, you mean?
Yes, yeah. And you can see it's like if a train spotter were trying to paint a picture of a train, and there would be too much detail in there, and they would have missed the big picture in looking at the tiny picture.
I also so loved what you just said about he had failure written all over his paintings. Which is sort of the artist's way, isn't it? Because everyone's bumbling about trying to sort of find the next idea. You know, the creative endeavor is fantastic.
There's a story about him in Vasari's Lives of the Artists, which I'm sure isn't true because the book's full of nonsense, but apparently on his deathbed, he was found clutching a piece of paper on which the secret of perspective was drawn. And it was a circle with lines radiating out of the center. And that's what he spent his entire life trying to.
How lovely that apocryphally someone slapped it in his hand for him to look at. Just before you go, dear, this is the answer.
Here you go, is the answer.
That's so lovely about what would we expect to be slapped in our hand to give us the answer?
Yeah, and then my third inspiration is, and there are a number of people I've known who've done this, and all the best teachers do it. You ask them a question, and they have the nerve to say, I don't know. In fact, it's anyone who has the nerve to say, I don't know, I think is an inspiration to me. It requires a real humility, and it requires a real kind of self-knowledge and truth to say, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. We can find it out, but I don't know. And I think that's a really important principle for me as well. I don't know the answer to that.
And that's a lovely attestation to the notion of confidence at its centre, the confidence to say, I don't know.
Yeah. And you can always spot a good teacher because they'll, at some point, you'll hear them say, I don't know. I love it. And it's one of my favourite phrases.
And one I don't doubt you don't have to use very often, but one I don't doubt you use.
Oh, yeah. I will always admit if I don't know something.
And that's that lovely teacher mantra of I don't know and I'll find out for you.
Absolutely. Yes, yeah. And it's some Greek philosopher, isn't it? That's the beginning of knowledge, is to know that you don't know anything. But I can't remember which one. I got distracted by Marcus Aurelius and forgot the Greeks.
A fine distraction, the Roman Marcus Aurelius. Lovely. Okay, now we could be at two things that never fail to grab your attention, a la squirrels from the film Up.
All right, yeah. Well, the first is bridges. I love a good bridge. I really, really like a good bridge. And I didn't realise quite how much I liked a good bridge until I was playing. We all like to annoy the ones we love, don't we?
Annoy them, did you say?
Yeah, annoy them.
Yeah.
One thing that really annoys my partner is if you ask her inane questions, particularly if they're ones that you actually want to know the answer to. So we were on a long train journey to Leeds, and she hates trains. So if you could only eat one vegetable for the rest of your life, what would that vegetable be? Is that that kind of level of question? And then I said, what's your favourite bridge? And then I suddenly realised, actually, you know what? I realised that actually bridges, I'm really fascinated by them and the way that they connect things, but they also mark the separation between things. They come in all sorts of shapes and sizes.
There's a lovely metaphor in this about in your life's journey about the metaphors from one opportunity to the next, the bridge.
Yeah, and the fact it's a journey between one and another.
Is an aqueduct. Yeah. What about the aqueduct?
My particular favorite is the Tamar Bridge. Don't know if you're familiar with that.
Well, I have there's a friend I know who works in learning and development who's called Tamar. So,
all right.
So, and I do know the Tamar Bridge, but it's just very interesting. Then you meet somebody who seems to be named after a bridge. Whether they were conceived against the railings of it, I don't really know. But,
but it's a particular, I find Tamar particularly interesting compared to the Clifton Suspension Bridge, which we both know and love.
Yeah.
Owned by Brunel. But he's another inspiration for me, Brunel. But what's great about him, he never does the same thing twice. So Suspension Bridge, he's designed with it, you know, a classic suspension art like that. And then Tamar Bridge, he's reversed that. So the arch goes the other way. And it's it's beautiful. It's, anyway. Yeah, so bridges is
lovely.
One always distracts me. Yeah. And another is, I realised as I was doing this the other day, I caught myself doing it. And then I realised it's the thing that I learned from my grandmother, who was one of the just Victorians, which is I like to read shop signs out loud as I drive past them. Henry Smith Collier. And she would do this. She would read out signs, names. It's something about the act of reading, but where there's kind of no narrative. And I think she was just very bored. She was never allowed to drive. My grandfather always drove, being just a historian.
Did you pick that up from her? So you've started to emulate her. So you're becoming your grandmother. I love that.
Yeah. And I didn't realise I had the habits until I was travelling in a car with people. And then I was saying the name. And they're fascinating, you know, the names on shops and the names.
If I was in the car with you, what we've done with our family historically, if Stan, for example, just randomly reads something, we go, free reading, please. It's when the child finds that they can just do reading of their own volition. So bless you for being a free reader, Toby Hulse. Are there any favourite shop signs that you've gone past that you particularly enjoy?
No, I mean, this has taken me very quickly into something which distracts me in a very negative way, which are the shop signs that are incorrectly punctuated.
Get him started.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a great one in, there's one of them in Backwell. Since we're on the X1 bus, we'll be passing it soon, which is Amy's Wine House.
I see what they've done there.
Yeah, but what's good about the one in Backwell is it's part of the chain. It's one chain of two. The other one is somewhere down towards Henley's. There's an Amy's Wine House there as well. And I can't remember quite what it says in the Backwell one, but it says something like Amy's Wine House, part of the chain or something. It's glorious.
they've really thought that through.
Yeah.
Love that. I think we might now be then at the quirky or unusual fact about you we couldn't possibly know until you tell us.
Yeah, so it's what's interesting about working with children and having children is you realise that essentially they're almost fully formed at the point of birth, aren't they? So if I think about how William was, like the amount of time of his delivery and how he was as a toddler, that's basically what he's like now as an 18-year-old, just in baby form, and similarly with Emily. So I'm quite interested in looking back at my own, as far back as I can remember, and trying to see if the seeds of who I am now are contained somewhere early on. And this is, I think, tells us everything you need to know about my playwriting career. So I wrote my first play when I was 8, and it was written for the Cub Scouts for me to get my entertainer's badge. And it was the story of a sailor who was simultaneously Sir Francis Drake and Sir Walter Raleigh, because I knew some historical facts, but I hadn't bothered to do the research. And so collated the two into this wonderful figure who sails around the world, brings potatoes and tobacco back to Britain, defeats the Spanish Armada on the way, and then lays a cloak down in front of Queen Elizabeth I whilst presenting her with the potato.
I give you Toby Hulse's Moby Dick right there.
And that play was performed by my six, obviously, and I got my entertainer's badge. But there's something. I wish I still had that script. I really do wish I still had it. I mean, I can remember writing it longhand. Obviously, this would have been 1975, something like that. No photocopies. Writing copies out longhand, giving them out to my six, that's performing them.
You never know. It might be in a scout hut somewhere random in its own glass case.
In Croydon, it would be then.
In Croydon. I love great, quirky, unusual fact. Thank you. We have shaken your tree, which was a delight. So now we're going to move away from the tree, but stay in the clearing. And you've been giving this by the bucket load anyway, but alchemy and gold now. And it's fairly implicit in how you've been letting your thinking unfold, Toby. But when you are at purpose and in flow, what is it you most like to be doing?
Playing. So whether that's playing in a rehearsal room or in a classroom playing with children or with friends playing a game or having a daft conversation with someone and just playing backwards and forwards, playing. I'm not a sports person, but I do like, all my favourite games have no winner in them whatsoever. I sound like some awful trendy primary school, don't I? Where everyone gets mentoring. And I particularly like pointless games, as in the pointless conversation. So games like Jenga I really enjoy because no one wins Jenga, it just ends and everyone loses.
Although, if I may, when it falls over, you get the blame for it falling over, don't you? So if
yeah, but then, so someone might lose, but no one wins. You can't win Jenga, can you? Twister, similarly, you can't win Twister. Everyone falls over and everyone laughs. So playing is what I like doing best. And I count myself very lucky that of the three careers I've had, two of them have involved substantial amounts of playing. And not much playing, Morgan Stanley.
And I don't know where this is coming from, but Twister is also a dangerous game because some people can get pregnant. Pish and tush. So I love that. Just being at play is when you're happy. I love that. So now I'm going to award you with a cake, Toby, which is a multi-layered cake where you're going to put a cherry on the cake, which is the legacy of our conversation. Mm. And we've arrived with plenty of time to be able to unpack this. It's also where we can resonate as the park-up point with Shakespeare. And I know, as I said, that you've done a rough, see what you're doing there, guide to Shakespeare in the play that you did. And you too have enjoyed riffing his artistically on The Seven Ages of Man. We'll get there. But the cherry on the cake takes the form of the best piece of advice you've ever been given, and or a favourite inspirational quote that's always given you succour and pulled you towards your future, even though you've given us you talked about Marcus Aurelius earlier on. Mm. And then finally, inspired by Shakespeare's All the World's a Stage, to both of our enjoyment, how would you most like to be remembered? What would you like Toby Hulse's legacy to be?
So the best version of my... the best piece... Sorry, the best advice that I've ever been given... was given to me, actually she gave me two pieces of advice, one of which I've been able to act on, the other I've never had to use, thank God. So when I was teaching at Bishop Road Primary School in Bristol, we had a fantastic deputy head called Rahana Siraj Allen, who then went on to be a head in Eastern. She's one of those inspirational teachers that you meet. And I was fairly newly qualified when she started. And she talked about having been a deputy head in a city school in London. And she gave me these two bits of advice. One is, if a parent comes in to your office looking for a fight, the first thing you should do is hand them a cup of tea on a saucer and a cigarette, because then both of their hands are occupied and they can't hit you. I've never had to use that piece of advice, but if in that situation, I remember, cup of tea on a saucer and a cigarette. But the other piece of advice you gave me was when someone, if a parent comes in to complain to you or an Ofsted inspector, or at any point someone starts to point out one of you, you know, something that's gone wrong, your answer should be, yeah, it's good, isn't it? So, and the example she gave was, so a parent came in to me and complained that their son's reading book hadn't been changed for 2 weeks. And you go, yeah, it's good, isn't it? That means they've had more time to consolidate their learning. So what she's suggesting is that idea of, yeah, it's good, isn't it? You should be sort of embracing, owning your mistake, embracing it, and then trying to find the positive thing inside that mistake. Because, yes, the reading book should probably have been changed more than after 2 weeks. But finding the good bit in the mistake, I think, is a really useful thing. And that, yeah, it's good, isn't it, is, I find it so helpful. And it's really helpful in rehearsals when something goes wrong and they go, oh, no, this won't work. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Because that means we can do this. Or, yes. Yeah, because that means, and it's just embracing the mistake is really important to me.
And embracing the mistake is a lovely through line in what we've been talking about, actually.
I always remember that moment where she told me that. I would also like to give you a quotation, if that's all right. I wrote it down on a bit of paper so I get it correct. So alongside Moby Dick, a very favourite book of mine is called Tristram Shandy by Laurence Sterne. And it's a wonderful book about nothing. Those of people who haven't read it, it saved them days of their lives. So Tristram Shandy is trying to give his life story, but he doesn't know where to start. And it's a book about a man who can't start a book. It goes on for 10 volumes with him. And it's just, he's getting all round about the house. It's about him talking about things that he can't talk about. He had some awful injury when he was a child, where his nursemaid held him out of the window and the sash dropped down. She held him out the window because he needed to urinate and the sash window dropped down. And then the rest of the book's about him talking about what it isn't that has been cut off. You know, it's not his, it's a brilliant, brilliant book. And was made into a great film with, what's his name? Steve Coogan, called A Cock and Bull Story, which is it's a very good version. But in the letter at the start of that book, he's writing to, I think it's Addison, the prime minister at the time. And he gives the reason why he's written the book. And he says, because every time a man smiles, but much more so when he laughs, it adds something to this fragment of life. Now that's something worth living for, I think.
And if I may, that sounds like a wonderful legacy and how you'd like to be remembered as well with that as the quote. Is that what you intended?
I could only ever paraphrase that. And I think he's put it perfectly. I think if after I'm long dead and gone, there are still some bits and pieces here and there that are making people smile and laugh, I'm just adding something to the fragment of life, then I think I've done a pretty good job.
Toby Hulse, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Just quickly, we've only got about a minute left, but just tell me where we can find out more about you, the wonderful Toby Hulse, playwright, theatre director and creative practitioner on the internet.
So if you look for Roustabout Theatre, so Roustabout is like a roundabout, but with an ST. It's the name of an Elvis Presley film, as it happens. Roustabout Theatre, there's all the stuff that my company's doing, and we're got a number of shows running at the moment, and there's loads of online stuff we've done too. That's where I am.
So, Toby, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence here in the Good Listening to Show clearing. I'm going to say a ta-ta to you with anything else you'd like to say?
No, I've just really enjoyed this. It's been really nice chatting with you. Thank you.
And I'll just say goodbye to you and do a quick outro for our listeners. Thank you very much indeed. You've been listening to me, Chris Grimes, and this has been Toby Hulse on the Good Listening to Show and podcast. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Good Listening to Show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, from me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
And goodbye.